Pentecost Sunday was just 2 days ago, still very close. The heat of the fire should still be tangible to us. No, it's a hot day. It's always a hot day. It was hot before Pentecost, it's still hot now. That's not the kind of heat I'm talking about. There's an interesting thing, though, that happens with Pentecost. Pentecost is one of the three big feasts of the year, right? There's Easter is the biggest, Christmas, Pentecost. But what happens with Easter is there's a long preparation period, and then there's a long celebration. We just finished it, 50 days celebrating Easter. With Christmas, there's a not quite as long a preparation period and not quite a long celebration, but it's still a period of celebration. But Christmas doesn't just end the next day. But with Pentecost, it suddenly, disappears. It's kind of strange. Now, yesterday we celebrated the Feast of Mary, Mother of the Church, which was certainly an extension of the Pentecost meditation, because Mary's called by theologians the spouse of the Holy Spirit. But still, we're in ordinary time, and if it were not for the fact that we're celebrating Christopher Magallanes and his companions today, martyrs, we would be in green today, and it would seem as if the Holy Spirit just disappeared from the scene. Now, it's not true, of course, but we have to be careful, because that's the impression we could get, that the big seasons are over and now there's nothing special going on. I think that's part of the reason why Father Francis liked to call this time of year post-Pentecost, because, yes, it's after Pentecost, but there's still a connection to Pentecost. In fact, we live in the historical era post-Pentecost, right? From Pentecost to the end of time, that's the period of history we live in, between the coming of the Holy Spirit and the second coming of Jesus, post-Pentecost. So we're in a season of the Holy Spirit, and we ponder the scriptures in light of that profound gift, the Holy Spirit. It doesn't mean there's going to be lots of mention of the Holy Spirit in the readings, but we read it with the awareness that we have received the Holy Spirit. Now, I know this is seventh week in ordinary time. These readings could just as easily have been read before Ash Wednesday, right? We could be in the much earlier in the year and still read the same readings. And if that were so, we would read this gospel about Jesus predicting his passion, and we would say, look, what Jesus is preparing us for Lent and Holy Week. And then we would see the disorder among the 12, and they're arguing about who's the greatest, and we would say, well, these men, they obviously need Lent. They need a period of purification. And we would read the selection from the letter of St. James, where he speaks about all the different disorders that are at work in us, and the root of all the problems in the world is the envy and the fighting and the passions and the infidelities and everything. And we would take this this reading is certainly good preparation for Lent. That's what I would say. But we're not in preparation for Lent. We're in the season of the Holy Spirit. So we read these same passages with this awareness. Yes, Jesus is predicting his passion, death, and resurrection. And that is the way in which salvation comes to us. We just read, in fact, in yesterday's gospel, the last moments of Jesus' life on the cross, his entrusting of his mother to the beloved disciple, and then the piercing of his side and the blood and water which flowed from his side. And in between those two moments, the moment of the entrustment of Mary to the beloved disciple and the flowing of the blood and water, there was this statement that said that Jesus delivered over the Spirit, which of course means he died, but it was in his death that he bestowed the Spirit, that was implied in John's Gospel anyway, the Holy Spirit. And Mary received that Spirit, of course. She received the blood and water. Okay, so and I'm saying we can certainly see in the post-Pentecost season a way to understand these readings. Let's stick with the gospel for a moment. After Jesus gives his prediction of his passion, and the disciples have no idea what he's talking about, and they're afraid to ask him, that's already the first hint that they're not yet living according to the Spirit. They're still living according to the flesh. And then it becomes obvious when Jesus says, well, what were you arguing about? And they are silent because they realize, oh, they were being dominated by their passions and by the desires of the flesh. And it turns out what they were discussing among themselves on the way was who was the greatest. So 12 guys walking along, the disciples of Jesus, arguing with each other about who's the greatest. I mean, that sounds like second graders, maybe third graders. I mean, who does that? Who goes around talking about how great they are? Well, actually, people do that. I know celebrities and sports figures and politicians do this, but it's a very immature thing to do, to start proclaiming your greatness. So anyone who's proclaiming his or her greatness is automatically somehow revealing his insecurities and his fears and his need for approval and a lot of immaturity in that kind of thing. And that's where the apostles were. I'm sure you know that the slogan of former President Trump is "Make America Great Again." Make America Great Again. And he's used this slogan now for, he's in his third campaign to run for president. Whatever you think about the politics of Trump, and that's not my place to talk about. But the idea of making America great again has generated a lot of discussion about what that means. What does it mean? What does that mean? America was great and now it isn't. It has to be great again. Was America ever great? And then, more deeply, what does it even mean to be great? What does it even mean to be great? And if you know that politicians, not only Trump, but pretty much every politician, their idea of greatness is, right, superiority, power, dominance, excellence, whatever. In other words, I don't know any politician that bases his or her definition of greatness on the scriptures. Certainly the Make America Great slogan doesn't come from the gospel, because when the apostles are arguing about who's the greatest, Jesus sits down, takes the position of a teacher to these children, these immature 12 disciples, and he says to them, gives them a lesson, if anyone wishes to be first, he shall be the last of all and the servant of all. It's a fundamental principle of spiritual greatness. That if you really want to be great, if you really want to be superlative, if you want to excel in the spiritual life, then be the last. Be the servant of all. I don't know anybody who says that in order for a country to be great, it has to be at the service of all other countries. Now, maybe people do think that, and maybe people think that to be at the service of the world, we have to have more money and more powerful weapons and bigger armies and better technology, and that makes you able to serve the world. Now, that's a kind of self-serving way of doing it, but like I say, I'm not here to talk about political or social programs. I'm here to declare this principle that Jesus states so clearly: if anyone wishes to be first, he shall be the last of all and the servant of all. Well, how can we do that? Can anyone who takes this inner disposition succeed in politics? I don't know. I don't know. Maybe a person like that wouldn't be elected, but that's a different question. We're not here because we're trying to be elected. We're here because we're followers of Jesus, and he's teaching his followers how to be great, how to be first, how to excel. We saw the greatest disciple of Jesus in yesterday's feast, Mary, Mother of the Church, Why is Mary so influential in the church? Why does she have such a high place? Because she's the lowest. She's the humblest. She's the last of all. She's the servant of all. That's why she reigns, queen of angels and men, because she's the lowest. She put into practice this principle. And then Jesus, in order to not only teach the principle, but to give a visual aid, he takes the child. We'd love to know who this child is and why that child was sitting around with the apostles, but maybe a relative of one of them. Because where do these children come from? Anyway, he takes one child and embraces the child. He puts his arm around the child. Here's Jesus, the master of the universe, embracing one nameless little child. And he says, whoever receives one child such as this in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but the one who sent me, the Father. And whoever receives the Father and the Son receives the Holy Spirit. And that's what we celebrated on Pentecost. So if you want the fullness of the Holy Spirit, if you want the fullness of divine life, receive one child in his name. One of the sad developments, again, maybe I'm too exposed to the American political scene, but one of the sad things is that the politicians who were claiming to be pro-life are all backing off from that position now because they don't think they'll get elected. So they're not that focused on one child or on the life of an unborn child. They're really focused on their own political survival. Again, they're not basing their position on the Bible, on the gospel. Jesus says the best thing to do here is to receive one child. Stand up for one helpless, marginalized person. Don't stand up for yourself first. Stand up for somebody else who has no one to stand up for them. That's what opens the way for God to reign. Okay. We turn to the first reading and we have James reminding us that even though these principles are clearly spelled out in the gospel, we have a really difficult time putting them into practice. Why? Because of our own broken condition, our own inner disorders. And that's the level James speaks about. He takes it for granted that the way to greatness is to serve others. He takes it for granted that we understand we should be for others. But he also understands that we don't do that because of we're dominated by our own fallen nature. Now, we're jumping into the middle of a letter of James. We didn't read from James, well, for a long time. So here we are in the fourth chapter. So it's kind of abruptly asks this question, where do the wars and where do the conflicts among you come from? Well, that's no way to start a letter, but we're not at the beginning of the letter. He's in the middle of a discourse, a challenging discourse, to get us to face the reality of our disorders so that we do something about it. Where do wars come from? Well, we look at the world situation and we say, well, wars come from dictators and from, land grabbers and evil men and power-hungry leaders, this sort of thing. And James says, no, he's not pointing at Putin or whatever world leader, Hamas. He doesn't point at anyone, he points at us. Is it not from your passions that make war within your members? Now he's talking to Christians, he's talking to people who are followers of Jesus, already baptized, already have the Holy Spirit, like us. He's not addressing the pagans here, he's addressing followers of Jesus Christ. And he says, wars come from the passions that make war within your members, your own inner problem, coveting, envying, selfishness, passions, praying with wrong intentions, asking with the idea of squandering whatever we get on our own passions. And then he says, let's make this clear. If you want to be a lover of the world, you're going to make yourself an enemy of God. You can't have two masters. So then he gives us the solution. Okay, submit yourselves to God. Make God your master. Don't make the devil your master. Don't make your flesh your master. Don't make political ambitions your master. Don't make any selfish ambitions your master. Make God your master. Submit yourselves to him. Resist the devil and he will flee. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Of course he will. He loves us. He has already given himself for us. He has already filled us with his spirit. He wants to be in communion with us. So cleanse your hands, purify your hearts, turn away from sin. And then the very last line, humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you. There it is, the same principle that Jesus said to the apostles. If you want to be first, be the last. If you want to be great, humble yourself. If you want to be effective, be the servant of all. Here's James repeating it. Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you. You don't have to exalt yourself. You don't have to make yourself the greatest. That's God's business. And he does it a lot better than we do for ourselves. So God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. That's our wisdom for the day. That's the challenge for post-Pentecost. It's a challenge that we can confidently take up because we can rely on the Holy Spirit. On our own, yeah, we're going to be adulterers and we're going to be murderers and we're going to be starting wars. That's just how it happens. But with the power of the Holy Spirit, we can be great if we're willing to be humble.